Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, fitness, nutrition, and all things lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. First this morning, we're joined by Danny Wallace, comedian, actor, filmmaker, and author. Danny has trained his sights on a contagion that leaves us feeling dreadful. It's rudeness. We discuss the finding in his latest book, F You Very Much.
You love that title, don't you? You just love it.
I've been dying to say that.
It's a tie-in to the interview that we did last week, I think it was. Swearing is good for you.
That's right.
Yes. Then it's our monthly art and culture segment curated by the Summit County Park City Arts Council. This month, we speak with Raina Wiles, an experienced designer who works with companies, governments, and local change leaders to apply design thinking and visual strategy approaches.
And then Dr. Robert Post joins us to discuss his upcoming presentation as part of the Connect Roundtable at Hotel Park City on February 22nd. Dr. Post will be presenting on the current trends in diagnosis and treatment of early onset or childhood bipolar disorder.
This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
G'day. This is Ashley from Campus Coffee, happy to sponsor programming on KPCW. We can't wait to serve the Park City locals this winter. We're excited by our breakfast and lunch menu to complement our espresso drinks. Campus Coffee is open daily at the base of Park City Mountain Resort, up the stairs from the ice rink next to the Adirondack chairs. CampusCoffee.com.
This is Mike Kirby with Big D Construction. Utah is our home, but we build commercial structures from coast to coast. We also build homes through our Big D Signature Group. More information about Big D's commitment to our customers and employees can be found at big-d.com.
This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Our first guest, Danny Wallace, is a humorist who has tackled a number of cultural subjects through films and books. In his new book, F You Very Much, Understanding the Culture of Rudeness and What We Can Do About It, Wallace is on a quest using his powers of introspection and observation to halt the epidemic of incivility. His book is an attempt to better understand the plague that's turning normal people into bullies, tantruming toddlers, and other types of everyday monsters. Danny Wallace, welcome to The Mountain Life. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, how often do you get called a Pollyanna?
I can tell you exactly how many. That's the first time anyone's ever called me that. So once is the answer.
And that was kind of rude of her, wasn't it?
Well, I've been called a Pollyanna before, and I take it as a compliment. But, there's been a theme throughout a lot of your work, going back to, I read about the Join Me movement that you started that became sort of cultish, where you were introducing civility and how people could come up with just nice things to do. And you even wrote another book about it. So it has been a theme, this civility.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And it wasn't really until I wrote this book that I realized quite how strongly, as a theme, it's run through my work over the years. And yes, you mentioned Join Me there, and that was an attempt a few years ago. I mean, it started innocently enough. I wanted to see whether people would join something without knowing who they were joining or what they were joining or even what joining meant. And it turns out they would. So I had suddenly lots of people joining this club, but the club had no point. And I thought, well, I've got an option here. I can either use my powers for mischief, or I can use my powers for good. And so I just asked people to do a random act of kindness for a stranger every Friday. And this they did. And it did kind of feel like it was making the world microscopically better every time we do something. Because if we do something nice for someone else, we feel better as well. So it's this incredible win-win situation. Whereas now, with this new book, I've discovered that the people who are rude are not only making the world microscopically worse, but they're making their own lives worse as well.
Absolutely. Well, just wondering for a moment here if you could define some terms, because You start off talking about how rudeness is sort of the opposite of civility, but you say that it's not the opposite of etiquette. Etiquette is dead, you say, and politeness is maybe what we're trying to achieve instead of rudeness.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there is, you know, it's not a book about manners or etiquette or anything like that. And as you say, I do really feel that etiquette is very kind of outdated. You know, I'm not going to take offense at what fork someone chooses to use when they're eating their salad. But I would like that person to say please or thank you.
Yeah.
I think that we can all hold a door open for a second or two longer if it helps the person who's struggling with bags. There are a very, very simple set of rules, unwritten rules that we have developed over millennia, which kind of just lubricate the day for everybody involved. That generally lead to an exchange of smiles. And it's very, very small and simple things that we have generally been very good to sticking to, and we stick to them because they work. But what I've really noticed in the last few years, it felt like there was just this coarsening of society and getting rid of some of these rules and railing against systems that kind of work. I think that we're at a point where we're celebrating the wrong things. You know, we celebrate people's rudeness because they say, well, they're just being honest. But I really don't think it is honesty. I think that we're at a time where everybody has to have an opinion on everyone else's behavior all the time. And they want to put these opinions in quite a forthright way because it makes them look better and more assured and smarter, but again, it makes the world worse.
Danny, that's fascinating because I was observing that your early work seemed to focus on civility and your current work seems to focus on rudeness. And that is a reflection of what you just spoke to. In the last few years, there's been a sea change. And I'm wondering if you can attribute that to anything in particular or if it's a number of things, social media, anonymity on social media, talking heads on programs, representing themselves as experts when we used to actually go to experts and they were never talking heads, right? I mean, now everybody, as you said, has an opinion.
Well, absolutely. And social media, I mean, that really hasn't helped. This kind of, you know, it's not enough anymore to have an opinion. Everybody has to then broadcast their opinion on social media or, you know, Facebook or Twitter or wherever. Everyone has to make those opinions as short and pithy as possible, so they have to cut through and get above the noise. It's the same trick that columnists do in order to get more clicks these days. They'll write the worst things they can in the worst way possible. You'll walk past someone watching, you know, cable news, and like you say, there'll just be people kind of shouting at each other, whereas once we'd have had proper journalists analyzing facts. And really, if we broaden out even, I mean, over there in America, you have the election, which kind of divided the country straight down the middle. Over here in Britain, we had Brexit, which again, cleanly down the middle, separated the country into two camps. And it feels like with social media, with reality TV, with all these things that kind of celebrate incivility, we're kind of on a knife edge. We want to react immediately to these people that we suddenly see as the enemy, even though really, I mean, you know, taking Brexit as an example, you know, we're making enemies out of people who voted differently on one issue to us, you know, 2 years ago. And it seems like that's enough now for everybody to want to, as we'd say in Britain, have a go at each other.
Are there any signs of hope for recovering from this era of celebrating incivility? Can you look to the past and say, wow, you know, this is a repeating pattern in history. We didn't have social media, but we had other means where people were very unkind to one another, and it's just part of the normal pendulum swinging. And I guess the question is, can we recover from a president who tweets?
Well, we can look to the past insofar as we can say that whenever we have had systems that really, really work for us, we rebel against them for whatever reason, because we want to kind of refresh society. We want to just go against what went before. And it's only then that we realize, oh, we had that system because it worked really well. So perhaps this sort of degradation of civility is there, is natural, and is good because it will make us all realize We need that. We need diplomacy. We need to have empathy. We need to care about other people and how they are feeling. And in terms of the future, well, I've talked to a lot of academics and scientists who are kind of working in the shadows, who really see rudeness as a genuinely damaging and quite dark thing, which can affect our health, our mental well-being, you know, how much we earn at work, how nice we are to our partners, and also how it affects people like surgeons or truck drivers or pilots, people who take other people's lives in their hands. Because there were a series of studies done that showed that when someone was rude to a surgeon, that surgeon then became 50% less effective at the surgery they were about to carry out, which is quite a terrifying thing if you're the person about to go under the knife. And I asked the same question of the scientists, you know, what can be done? This is a silent killer. And there's one scientist in particular who seems to almost be developing a sort of rudeness vaccine that doctors, like a series of exercises that a doctor can do at the start of their day, which kind of inoculates them against any rudeness they might have from stressed patients or, you know, angry family members or just people who want to have a shout at a doctor. And it means that it almost resets their brain to be able to kind of focus on the important things and not on the rudeness that's happening. And as to your point of, you know, can America, you know, recover from a president who tweets? Well, the problem is when you have someone who is quite a rude man, I think that we can all agree he's fairly rude, rude to other countries, always coming up with dismissive nicknames for people, rude to minority groups. The problem is that when someone at the very top is showing an entire country, I got to the top and I'm this rude, it's also saying it's okay to behave in this way. People kind of respect rudeness because it breaks the rules, and they sort of think, well, if he got there by, you know, and he was that rude, it must be all right. And then that message trickles down, and a whole generation of people start to behave in a way that really they ought not. And then they teach their children to act in that way. So you have a new generation coming up who will kind of be affected by this rudeness. So really, it's sort of like a rudeness bomb. And it could well, I feel, take America and the world generations to really deal with the fallout.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Danny Wallace. He is a writer and a humorist. He has a new book out. It's called F You Very Much, Understanding the Culture of Rudeness and What We Can Do About It. And we might also mention that one of your books, Yes Man, was adapted for film. Mm-hmm. And I think most of us remember Jim Carrey having to say yes to everything for, was it 6 months in the screenplay anyway?
I think in the film, yeah, he just thought, I'm going to adopt this. I did it for 6 months. I sort of felt like I'd been saying no too much. Uh-huh. And I just kind of, it was one of those things where I wasn't depressed, but I was quite sort of content. But friends would phone up and sort of say, hey, do you want to come to this great thing? And before I'd even heard what the great thing was, I would already have prepared my answer, which was, oh, I can't. I can't. And I wasn't doing anything. I was just sitting at home watching TV. And slowly I realized that was not healthy. Yeah. So, you know, being a boy, I just thought, well, why don't I just go, you know, all out in a slightly stupid way. And I will say yes to everything from now on. And so that's what I ended up doing.
Well, it's all about this sort of culture of positivity, which you're trying to counter the rudeness with as well. And it leads me into another question about rudeness as contagion. Mm-hmm. And your intro story about Madame Hot Dog and this encounter that you had, which I'll ask you to talk about in a moment, it made me think about a recent incident I've had in which someone was quite rude to me. And I stewed on it for days. And what I first tried to do was to introduce compassion and to say, that person really has a miserable life, is ultimately not a happy person, and therefore I feel sorry for this person. Nevertheless, as much as I tried to think that, I kept coming back with this feeling in my gut that was negative. I should have, when introducing compassion, felt very positive and nurturing, but instead, well, and when I read in your book about rudeness as a contagion, I wondered if that's what was happening to me. It was actually making me ruder. Talk about hot dog lady.
Well, yeah, I will. Well, essentially, all I wanted was a hot dog. And it should be very, very simple to get a hot dog. You go to a place that sells hot dogs, and you just say, I'd like a hot dog. And that is, you know, that's as long as the story should have ever been.
Yeah.
But I went to the hot dog place, and I asked for my hot dog. And I don't know if you've ever walked into somewhere, and it's almost like the person behind the counter has already taken against you for whatever reason, and you have no idea why. But you just try and sort of push through, just make it all right. So I ordered this hot dog. She made me pay up front as if I was some kind of flight risk, like I always just sort of walk around various places just ordering hot dogs and running off. But I you know, I paid up front, and my son wanted one as well, my little boy. And so we wait, and 10 minutes pass, and then another five, and I think, well, maybe I should just pop in. And so I pop in, and I very, very politely asked, how long the hot dog might be. Using words like that, how long might it be? You know, kind of always keeping any sense of aggression at arm's length. And she was furious that I'd come in to ask where this hot dog was, and she sort of told me off and said it wouldn't be long. And so I had to go outside and wait some more. And to cut a long story very short, I waited 1 hour and 1 minute for this hot dog to arrive. And I thought, look, this is way too long. And I'd been in a couple of times. I'd asked where it was, always kind of been shouted at. And this is where I thought, no more. And so that's when I kind of stepped up. And I didn't become aggressive, but I certainly, you know, raised my voice a little bit to match hers. And, you know, I ended up being ejected from the diner, banned for life, thrown out into the drizzle, with no hot dog. That's the tragedy of the situation. And like you, I stewed on it. Because when someone breaks those rules, you know, the scientists say it essentially affects the frontal lobes, the things that deal with kind of working memory and the tasks that might be at hand. And it's why people often can't think of something witty to say when someone's rude to them. You know, it's always half an hour later they think, oh, I wish I'd said that. And it affected me to the point where a day or so later, I went past that diner again, and it was at night, and it was empty, and there was no one around. And I found myself, as a grown man, doing a rude hand gesture just at a building, which is not normal behavior. And that's when I started to think, you know, this is really affecting me. And it dredged up old memories of rudeness, and I started to look into it. And when you mentioned the contagion, now anyone who had watched me in that diner that day, there were maybe a dozen people, science says that just witnessing that woman being rude to me, and perhaps me being rude to the woman in return, will have made those witnesses ruder. Because rudeness is said to spread almost like the common cold. So it can rip through a workplace or a school or a street just by having been witnessed. So when you have witnessed rudeness, you are now primed to see rudeness. And later on in your day, you might be slightly more aggressive with somebody, or you might get an email which is completely neutral in tone, but you will now see maybe elements of sarcasm where perhaps there isn't any sarcasm intended, or passive aggression when actually the person's been completely neutral. So it's a bit like we have this thin layer of skin, this thin layer of civility, and just a scratch, just a graze is enough for our own incivility to come out in turn.
Danny, we're almost out of time, but I have to ask you this one question. And you've even said this could have been a silly book. So my question is, you're a humorist. You've taken a comedic approach to a number of subjects and topics. But I think you found that this was an important topic that required actual journalism. So what was that process like, going from a silly story and a possibly silly book into something that really delves into the research and the experts and becomes, you know, an important commentary on civility?
Well, I loved it. I always like trying new things. And when I start to realize, hey, there's something a lot kind of deeper here, and it feels very timely, it feels quite zeitgeisty because of everything that's happening in the world right now, it really did feel like rudeness was a very important topic. It felt very important to me. It was also hugely cathartic because I was able to kind of try and find out what happened that day between me and the hot dog lady. But also look at the world and everything that I find so confusing at the moment, how rude we are to one another on social media, how instantaneously angry people can seem to get on the roads, why we are now voting in politicians who prefer put-downs to policies. All of this confused me. And so the book was an attempt to make sense of it. And I think certainly I have made sense of it to me. And I can only hope that that it will help whoever reads it make sense of it, too.
Absolutely. Danny Wallace, I enjoyed this book so much.
Thank you.
As Tim said, it went from being something sort of light and funny into something that really I'll take with me throughout my day and the next couple, thinking about this culture. So I appreciate that you've written it.
Thank you.
And the book is F You Very Much, our guest, Danny Wallace. Thank you for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And stay with us. We'll be back from the culture of rudeness to talking about design thinking with this month's installment of the Arts and Culture curated by Park City Summit County Arts Council. When we return, stay with us.
Valley Behavioral Health is a local nonprofit and proud supporter of KPCW. We are your community behavioral health center and provide a broad range of services, including individual, family, couples, and group therapy for mental health and substance abuse. We serve all ages in all of Summit County. Please check out our website at valleycares.com or 649-8347 for more information.
Programming for KPCW is sponsored in part by Mark Wangsgard and Jim Doilney of Retail at New Park, part of the development team of New Park Town Center and co-owners of the New Park Sun Plaza, location of many Park City community events.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, Raina Wiles is an experienced designer, who is here to discuss how she brings design thinking approaches and visual recording strategies to tackle community challenges. She worked as a graphic recorder with the ABC Project Summit last November to represent ABC data in visual digestible pieces. She produced a real-time visual map to document the conversations and actions from the day. She's joined by Hadley Dynek, who curates this monthly arts and culture segment on The Mountain Life. Hadley is the executive director of the Park City Summit County Arts Council. Welcome to you both. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Thank you.
So that sounded a little bit confusing, that intro, I think, in terms of a visual representation of a conversation. So maybe you can just take us through that really quickly.
Sure, absolutely. Really, the foundations for visual recording, and please stop me if I'm starting to use jargon. You can say, hey, that's not a real word. Use a real word. The real foundation for doing visual recording is helping people see their words on a blank canvas. So what you start with is you start with a blank piece of paper, and as the conversation progresses, you literally record what people are saying, word for word, as much as you can. And just by doing that action, you make their words larger than life, and you make the conversation tangible. And it becomes something that the entire group can speak to and can remember after the fact in the meeting. So that specific practice of visual recording is about making a meeting very tangible by making the conversations seen and sensed on a piece of paper. Does that make sense a little bit?
Absolutely, you know? Absolutely. And makes the participants able to refer back to what brilliant thing someone else said 5 minutes before that you can never quite remember or redo.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So how does this tie into design thinking? And that's a term that we've used here and have done some really interesting interviews on about design thinking. But how do you see it?
Sure. That's a great question. I see them working very much hand in hand as design thinking, as I'm sure you're familiar with design thinking. It's really a process for how to problem solve and how to approach problem solving by really going out into the world and finding needs, looking at those needs and saying, what are some insights and patterns that we can draw from? And then saying, okay, how do we solve for those problems, as opposed to kind of just going off the cuff and introducing a solution that might not take root because it doesn't make sense for the community. So that whole process of informed design is really what design thinking is about. And visual recording and facilitation in particular is engineered sounds really technical, helps teams navigate that process, because that process is very abstract. It's very subjective. Unless you have, you know, a facilitator or a rubric, it can seem very confusing. So having artifacts that people can point to say, I remember that idea that we talked about in that meeting 10 weeks ago, or even if people are in a room together, what tends to happen in meetings is people will continue to refer to the same idea over and over again because they feel like they're not heard by the rest of the group. So if that idea is captured on a wall, it helps the conversation progress. So visual recording helps in all of those instances where communities and teams are working together to try to solve a problem they're trying to run quickly. It helps provide some tangibility to those conversations.
I was part of Raina's, well, the presentation by ABC, and I saw your work. And so first I want to say, Hadley, is there a place where people can go and see the final product of what was produced visually of this conversation?
Yes. So Project ABC website, projectabcsc.com. And if you click on the progress page and scroll down about halfway, you'll see all of the artifacts that were created at the summit.
And I have to say that I left about a third of the way through the day because it was a long day and I had other meetings. But I saw the beginning of this visual representation, and to watch it evolve in real time was astounding to me. I couldn't believe what you were doing. But then to see the final product, not having seen it in real time be created, I was just like, it's beautiful. And to take something, a conversation, and transform it, I'm really curious about how that happens. I mean, and where did this begin with you? I'm thinking not everybody has this skill. Maybe it started with doodling in class, you know, and as a professor or teacher is talking, you're doodling, and that doodling then all of a sudden sparks something. How did it happen that you became a visual artist who represents conversation?
You're right. I did start in school taking notes by doodling fairies in the little borders of my notebooks, much to the chagrin of my parents and my teachers. But I really was able to refine the skill, and it became a real skill, because I think it's one of visual recording is one of those things that you, when you see it and you see it done well, you say, oh, that was cool. But having a trainer or a mentor saying, this is an actual practice, these are the frameworks around how to do this well, was really helpful for me. And that happened after college at a company called Jump Associates. They're a small product strategy and overall strategy group based in San Mateo, California. My instructors in school from Stanford worked there, so I went and worked there after school, after I graduated from college. And they were really strict in a good way about how to facilitate teams with the right artifacts, with the right activities, and with the right types of visual recording practices. So they really led me through, this is how you start. And I think a lot of what it is, this is a tricky thing about visual recording that might not be as obvious. It definitely wasn't to me, is that visual recording is as much about having, you know, some sort of sketching and hand lettering skill as it is about being a good listener. Because actually what you're doing is you're almost kind of simulcasting. You're listening out of one ear into what the conversation is in real time, and you're recording with your body, and then you're listening to stuff come in, and you kind of have a backlog of ideas and words and things that you're hearing come in, but your hand isn't necessarily caught up with that in real time. So you kind of have to keep a backlog. It's very meditative. It starts to become like a meditative process where you're almost like just kind of a conduit for the conversation, and you're passing it from your ears onto paper.
And you have to be careful not to put your own lens on it, which is we all do all the time in every conversation. So how do you avoid that?
Some of my lens might be in there.
No, fair enough.
I think, well, the way that I was trained from Jump was you use the words, you use exactly the words that people are using in the room. You don't try to interject too much of your own inference. What you do though, and why I say is there is a little bit of Obviously, creative liberty, but there is a little bit of the visual recorder's personality injected is in the overall structure of the representation. And what you do as a visual recorder is you're listening to all these kind of artifacts come in, and you're grouping them in real time. So as the conversation evolves, you're starting to say, hey, these are all conversations around this chapter or this theme that's really about collective action, as an example. And then you kind of write collective action and you box it in and you make that apparent and visual for the rest of the group. So there is a little, that's why it's called facilitation.
Sure.
You are kind of synthesizing ideas as you go.
What you choose to backlog and then what you choose to group and how you choose to represent it, that's where your lens comes in.
Yes.
So the people at Jump, when they came across, this is going to sound weird, but when they came across you, were they like, whoa, person with superpowers, because what you're describing to me sounds so outside of the realm of even comprehensible. I don't understand how anybody, and how many artists like you are there? Is it a tiny little group of people who can do this? Because it just seems just unimaginable to be able to translate the way that you do.
Thank you. The interesting thing about Jump is that they force everybody who's a part of the company to be able to do this.
Wow. How many people are there? Like four?
40 to 50, actually. 40 to 50. It's a pretty good small group, at least when I last checked in with them. It was my first job out of school, so I'm sure they've grown since then. But yeah, it was part of kind of the skill set that you had to have for being to be a jumpster, they called it. So when I came in, I actually didn't have a lot of that particular, I had a lot of hand skills because I did more design, practical design or practicum-based design work in school, but hadn't necessarily honed in the, not only the facilitation skills of, say, of being able to visually record and orchestrate a room and the conversation around what I was recording, but also just that listening skill of being able to do that simulcast in real time. Those were kind of new things that I bolstered onto my existing skill set. So I'd say that, you know, for me, visual recording became something that felt more like a natural fit versus, I think, for other folks, they leaned more towards perhaps just using words and colors. And using just words and colors on a canvas is still visual recording. Because of my background in art, I was able to introduce a little bit more illustration and color.
So I have to ask, and Hadley, maybe you can answer this too. We all go to a lot of meetings, and at a lot of those meetings, notes are taken, and sometimes they're even taken on a whiteboard or on a, something that is able to visual or to see from the whole group's perspective. So how was what Raina did different, and how did it help you achieve solutions during the ABC project?
Well, I think the ABC Summit, maybe I'll start and you jump into from your perspective, Raina, was a little mini design thinking experience that we wanted to create and bring to the community. And so the center of that is around putting the needs of the users, or in our case, these seven different stakeholder groups that have been involved in the project first. So Raina designed these posters that represented those needs that had come from all of the data that we collected last summer and put them around the room. So that was a piece of information that was data that we had collected that was used to inform the process and the conversation. So that's one way that it was used, was to help the people that were coming into the room maybe for the first time interacting with the process get grounded immediately in a visual way in some of the information. And then, you know, understanding how to frame the problem, which in our case is building a roadmap for the future of arts and culture in Summit County, we needed to take all of those pieces of data from the different stakeholder groups and think about new ways to frame the problem and come up with solutions. So that was really this conversation of these seven priority areas that we have, and Raina created giant posters for those as well so that people could go up to them, they could read the kind of how might we affect change in creating spaces for arts and culture in Summit County with a bunch of the strategies that came out. And then people could actually interact with them and put little dots on them. And there was a process of absorbing and then interacting with. Those happen to be up in our little basement office right now, kind of surrounding us at all times, Jake and I at all times, so that we can be making sure that everything that we're doing as we move through this process is grounded in the conversation that we had that day. And then we had this action planning breakout section near the end of the day where people were taking all of that information and saying, well, what does that mean for me? And how do I prototype or ideate, which are design thinking terms, you know, come up with solutions for a different aspect of these priorities. So, and then Raina's work on the giant poster was reflecting in a thematic way all of those conversations that were happening. So it was kind of like the master map, if you will, mm-hmm. of what we were sharing and then what people were sharing back.
Wow, very cool.
That was a lot.
That was a lot, but it explains it. And it also occurs to me that what it's doing is something on a subconscious level that we don't even realize is both opening up our creativity and it is kind of twisting our own reality in some way and probably making us better problem solvers. And before we let you go, you mentioned you went to Stanford.
I did.
So were Bill Burnett and Dave Evans your professors there? Because their book, Designing Your Life, is so fascinating to me. And we've interviewed them a couple of times.
Oh, fantastic.
On this show and I think Cool Science Radio. But just about that prototyping for your life is fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was there, I think the D school was definitely just kicking off. It was still in a temporary housing status. David Kelly was my advisor on and off. He was peers to Bill Burnett. I remember I saw him in the elevator as I was coming back or coming out of a class. And I was like, hey, how's D school going? And he was like, oh, it's great. We're in temporary housing now. It's perfect. So unfortunately, that kicked up just as I, it really got going just as I graduated. So I kind of missed the little curve there. But a lot of the curriculum was about design thinking. And the interesting thing about, I think, design thinking, which the book touches on, hopefully, is the idea that it is really a problem-solving approach that you can use for anything. It is a very democratic process that doesn't just have to be used for consumer products or businesses. So the idea that it can be applied to all sorts of different aspects of your life is very powerful.
So are you around? Are you in Park City? Or why are you here visiting with us? And I'm just wondering from the standpoint of, are you going to be involved in projects with the community going forward? Because that was just so amazing, the way that you brought art to something that's very analytical, or could be, and generally is, the whiteboard version versus what you produced side by side. There's a tremendous difference.
My intentions are, yes, to continue working with Hadley and the wonderful community here that you have. I'm based in Salt Lake at the moment. I was in San Francisco for 14 years or so and just moved out about a year and a half ago. So somewhat new to the community, but I'm willing and very excited to work with new people.
Nice. Design thinking takes over Utah. I like it. Raina Wiles, thank you so much for joining us. And Hadley Dynack, as always, thank you for setting up this little segment that we so enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you.
And when we return, we'll be speaking with Dr. Robert Post about a February 22nd Connect. That's the summit convening with the Summit County Mental Health Service, a providers roundtable at Hotel Park City. And he'll be talking to us about early onset or childhood bipolar disorder. Stay with us.
Whitney Wall here from Park City Mountain and KPCW sponsor. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
This is Rich Trujillo, food and beverage manager of Park Meadows Country Club. We are proud sponsors of Mountain Life on KPCW. Our members have varied menus with something for every taste in our private dining room and bar with weekly lunch and dinner specials. More info about membership at parkmeadowscc.com.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson from Davidson Orthopedics, proud sponsor of KPCW. We're pleased to announce the opening of our new Park City office in New Park at 1122 Center Drive, right behind Jupiter Bowl. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. We were just speaking with Raina Wiles about design thinking. Certainly was an interesting conversation.
You have to see what she produced to really get it.
Right. And I haven't seen it, so I'm going to be sure to look on it. What was the website again?
Well, it's
Project
the ABC.
ABCPC.com. Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah. Well, on February 22nd, Connect will convene the Summit County Mental Health Service Providers Roundtable that will be taking place at Hotel Park City. Our next guest is Dr. Robert Post. He's an internationally recognized psychiatrist, researcher, and author, and he's also one of the presenters. Dr. Post will join us now to preview his topic, which is early onset or childhood bipolar disorder. And we're waiting to get him on the line right now. And in fact, let's take a quick underwriting break to find out where he is. And we'll be right back after that. Stay with us.
Wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday at 6:50 and 7:50 during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher. Brought to you in part by Big D Construction, DeJuria Center at High Star Ranch, and Esco Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electrical. That's Esco, E-S-C-O.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. We're waiting to get Dr. Robert Post on the line. Dr. Post is an internationally recognized psychiatrist, researcher, and author, and he'll explore the current trends in the diagnosis and treatment of early onset or childhood bipolar disorder. He'll be in Park City on Thursday, February 22nd at 11 a.m. at Hotel Park City. This is brought to you by Connect Summit County's Mental Health Service Providers Roundtable. And we're pleased to be speaking with Dr. Robert Post. Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for joining us. First of all, let's talk a little bit about your topic that you will be speaking about when you come to town, and that is early onset or childhood bipolar disorder. Can you talk about some of the statistics?
Yeah, I can. It turns out that in the United States, there's an excess of early onset bipolar disorder compared to Europe. And about 25% of the illness starts in a child below age 13. 75% of bipolar illness starts before age 19. So in the United States, it's an illness of child and adolescent onset. In Europe, only about a third starts before age 19. So we have much more of it in the United States, and it's not well enough recognized.
And what is that attributed to?
Yeah, we've looked at a bunch of potential reasons, and two of the biggest ones is it appears that we have more family history, not only of bipolar illness, but also depression, alcohol, and substance abuse, and in the families from the U.S., and that goes to parents and grandparents. And the more the family loading for these illnesses, the earlier the age of onset. So that's one factor, and then the other factor is psychosocial stress. We have more stress in childhood than they do in Europe. And those two factors are big ones for driving early onset illness. And if you have a lot of family loading for psychiatric illness and the child has a lot of psychosocial stress, that gives you sort of an additive effect, and those folks have an average age of onset usually below 13 or 13 or below. If you have no family history and no stress in childhood, the average age of onset in our network was 26 years. So that's a more typical age of onset that's cited in most textbooks, but in the U.S., we have a lot of genetic vulnerability and environmental stressors.
Dr. Post, I'm curious. Your focus seems to be on onset, and then you're kind of speaking about onset in terms of recognition versus understanding. And if you could explain the difference between those two for people like myself who have no idea of really any basis of understanding, much less recognition. I'm assuming that we understand a great deal about bipolar disorder, but what you're delving into is the recognition and the difference between different areas of the world and also the stressors.
Yeah, and the issue is recognition of the illness in childhood so that one gets appropriate treatment, because the childhood onset illness is one that ends up in adulthood with a more difficult course. So you want to get after it early and well. And to recognize it in children, you need to go beyond the usual things of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, where people are activated, distracted, have difficulty staying on task, that kind of thing. And ADHD is much more common than bipolar illness. And many of these kids have both comorbid attention deficit disorder, that is ADHD, and bipolar disorder. And if you have both, you need to treat the bipolar disorder first and then the ADHD. But what happens, since there's so few bipolar medicines for children out there, the kids who have both tend to get treated just with ADHD medicines. So the things that tell you the kid might be bipolar is they have unusual periods of mood elevation and euphoria, either brief or extended periods. They had less need for sleep. They have aggression and discontrol. They can have hallucinations and delusions. They can be hypersexual. They can be suicidal and depressed. So the fluctuation in these kids' mood from up to down can be quite rapid. The youngest kids have sometimes multiple fluctuations in mood within the course of the day, thinking they can do all kinds of wonderful things one minute and then in their room hiding out crying the next minute. So it's there's three kinds of bipolar illness. Bipolar 1 is a full-blown mania that lasts a week or more. Bipolar 2 is just a little bit of hypomania lasting 4 days. And then bipolar not otherwise specified is what I just described, where you only have brief bursts of mania that don't last for 4 days. But it turns out that the kids with bipolar not otherwise specified still have very tough-to-treat illness, and it takes quite a period of time to get them mood stabilized.
Now, is it correct to interpret this that there's a certain percentage of the population of kids, of adolescents, or just people in general, who have a bipolar tendency that then either gets triggered or doesn't get triggered? And then also, as part of that, I hear you talking about condition, disorder, and illness. And where do we make the determination as to what's a condition, what's a disorder, and what's an illness?
Yeah, well, you call it bipolar disorder, but it's really an illness. Some of these kids are very sick. They don't do well in social family situations. They can get kicked out of school. So the difference is actually dysfunction when they can't be in their usual social, educational, family role. Then it gets to the point of disorder, which sort of equals illness.
You talk a little bit, or you will be speaking when you come to Park City, about the return of lithium as a treatment option. And I'm wondering about how lithium, when administered to a child, especially one under 13, how it differs from an adult.
Yeah, people have been reluctant to use lithium as much as it ought to be in adults. Because you need to measure blood levels, and it just isn't used as much as it should be, because lithium does all kinds of good things in the adults. In the kids, it's a little trickier, but the data are positive that lithium is helpful in youngsters, too. But the other drugs for kids are the anticonvulsant mood stabilizers, which are things like Valproate or Depakote, carbamazepine or Equitro or Lamotrigine, Lamictal. Those three anticonvulsants are used a fair bit in kids, along with the atypical antipsychotics. And the combination of those two are often given to the youngest kids. And lithium is just starting to be used in the early teenagers.
Wow. Don't have much time left. I would love to ask you, maybe when you come to Park City, to clarify this relationship between ADD, ADHD, and bipolar disorder in children. It's a really fascinating topic, and again, you'll be coming to Park City for the Connect Summit County Mental Health Service Providers Roundtable. It's taking place Thursday, February 22nd at 11 a.m. at Hotel Park City. And your presentation will be free and open to local mental health professionals as well as community members with an interest in this subject of childhood bipolar disorder. Space is limited, and you can RSVP to connectsummitcounty@gmail.com. And for more information, go to connectsummitcounty.org. And Dr. Post, we thank you so much for joining us today on The Mountain Life.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Look forward to the talk.
Yes, so do we. Thank you. And we'll be right back after these words.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life, and I thank our underwriters.
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Valley Behavioral Health, Park Meadows Country Club, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Davidson Orthopedics, Jim Doinley and Mark Wainsgard with retail at New Park. And did I miss anybody, Lynn?
I think you got it there. Park Meadows Country Club.
I got that one.
Oh, okay. Very good. You've got it down. Got it wired. Also want to thank our guest today. What an interesting program today. Danny Wallace was our first guest. And he's the comedian, actor, filmmaker, and author. His book is F You Very Much, Understanding the Culture of Rudeness and What We Can Do About It. And then our monthly art and culture segment, curated by the Summit County Park City Arts Council. We spoke with Raina Wiles, an experienced designer. She works with companies and governments and local change leaders to apply design thinking and visual strategy approaches. And then Dr. Robert Post, who again will be here in Park City on February 22nd at the Connect Roundtable at Hotel Park City. It begins at 11 o'clock and it's free and open to the public. It's KPCW Park City, time for news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi.